In Syria, 12 months since the fall of the Assad family, people are still pinching themselves.
Who would have believed as a Syrian a year ago that in 1 year we would have a country recognized by the international community? We would have a country at peace with everybody.
Syrians take stock of their new country. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also today, how the Trump administration's new national security strategy is being received abroad.
In black and white, it does seem a fundamental shift in U.S. geostrategic priorities.
How that shift looks from Latin America.
And airline passengers across India thrown into chaos.
Ma'am! Ma'am! Call someone! Get the customer!
That's today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here today. We begin with celebrations in Syria. In town squares across the country, people gathered to mark 1 year since the fall of the Assad regime. Many were proudly waving the new Syrian flag.
It was this time last year that the sudden and dramatic change took place. On this program, we'd been giving daily updates as Syrian rebels overtook one city after another, the momentum building until the surprising capture of Damascus on December 8th, 1 year ago. Longtime dictator Bashar al-Assad escaped on a plane to Russia. Opposition leader Ahmad al-Shara became the de facto leader of the country and eventually took the helm of a new government.
It was a moment of immense joy and deep uncertainty. A year later, we have two different personal perspectives about what is happening in Syria. The World's Shirin Jafari has our story.
None of that happened overnight. For the past 5 decades, Syria has been run by a family that didn't hesitate to commit atrocities. The Syrian uprisings against the regime began in 2011. They were crushed with force. Security forces killed hundreds of thousands of people. The Assad army, with the help of Russia and Iran, leveled entire cities. More than half of the population was displaced, according to the United Nations. That was the backdrop to what happened last year.
We needed some sort of movement in Syria. We needed some sort of international attention.
Anas Zain al-Abidine's parents are from Daraa. That's where the uprisings began. His father was a political activist, and the family moved around, eventually settling in Birmingham in the UK. Zain al-Abidine says growing up in the UK, not that many people around him knew where Syria was. They didn't know much about its food or culture. He wanted to change that, and so he decided to start a cafe.
I named it Damascena, only because I was emotionally attached to Syria.
Damascena, that's the name of a rose from Damascus. It's known for its fragrance and beauty. Zain al-Abidine made his first trip to Syria in 2007. Instead of a warm welcome, he was detained, questioned, and accused of being a spy.
When I was being interrogated, I can see people being dragged in. I can hear shouting and probably torture in the lower floors.
He was lucky, he says. He had a British passport and was let go. It was only after the fall of Bashar al-Assad last year that he would get a true sense of his own country.
I was on the third plane to land in Damascus Airport after the liberation.
It was an emotional homecoming for many others on the plane as well, he says. Exiled dissidents, those who had risked their lives crossing borders. They were all going back for the first time in years.
The emotions were overwhelming. I remember the plane landing and almost every single person on the flight was in tears.
Since then, Zain al-Abidine has been back 4 times. He wants to be part of the reconstruction, he says, and there are so many needs to be met. During Assad's rule, the country was isolated from much of the outside world. The US imposed sanctions on the country, which left its economy in shambles. Most Syrians didn't have access to basic services and goods. That's why Zain al-Abidine is considering investing in the country.
One of the things that I want to invest in is milk. I'm a coffee drinker and I love milk. And I think there's a gap in the market in Syria as things stand.
Besides the shattered infrastructure, though, there is a lot of red tape.
You can't open a bank account because you need an ID card. You can't get an ID card because the ministry that produces ID cards is closed.
Despite all that, things are slowly moving forward, he says. So far, he's cautiously optimistic about the new leader, Ahmad al-Sharaa. He's opening the country to the outside world, he says, pushing for economic sanctions to be lifted.
I will give Ahmad al-Sharaa a chance until he gives me a reason not to give him a chance and, you know, be negative towards him. We can openly say this in Damascus now. We can say it in Syria. I can say it on my Twitter account or on my Facebook account and not be worried about the repercussions in Syria.
While some Syrians remain hopeful about the rise of al-Sharaa, others like Amro Khaito say they've been discouraged.
We had divided Syria before, but it was not formal as it is today.
The war left Syria fragmented. The Kurds in the northeast carved out their own autonomous region. The western city of Idlib was under al-Sharaa's control, and the capital, Damascus, became its own bubble. Khaito says al-Sharaa hasn't done enough to change that. And now Israel is controlling parts of the south and bombing the country on a regular basis. Khaito was excited to see Assad go.
It was like a dream, actually.
He's experienced the brutality of Assad's prison system firsthand. He was imprisoned and later released. But his brother's fate was different. He was arrested at a checkpoint in 2015 while leaving a city that was under opposition control. The security forces, known as Branch 215, assumed that he was part of the opposition, Khaito says.
When you get captured by 215 Branch, then you go into the killing machine.
A killing machine. That's how human rights groups and activists have described Assad's detention centers. Khaito never found out what happened to his brother. The experience led him to found a website called Syria Prison Museum. With the help of other Syrians, he collects and documents evidence from detention centers.
Most of the team that is involved on this project, they have personal stories. They have relatives or themselves, they've been in these prisons.
Just last week, a new trove of photos was published. More than 70,000 images of dead detainees taken by Syrian military photographers between 2015 and 2024. Since coming to power, the new leader, al-Sharaa, hasn't made transitional justice a priority, Khaito says. Something that's been frustrating for him is how much of the evidence inside the prisons was destroyed.
I think they have done a really miserable job. These sites had like millions of evidence for the people who lost their lives. Most of it is being reused again, maybe transformed into something else.
al-Sharaa came into power as an interim leader, he adds, but he's been acting as an elected one. Elections don't seem to be on the horizon, he says. Of course, Syria is better off with Assad no longer in power. But it's time for al-Sharaa to start delivering on what is important to all Syrians, Khaito says. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Ah, the joys of air travel. And when I say joys, I mean the opposite, of course. That is the sound of frustrated airline passengers at Mumbai's airport yelling at representatives of IndiGo, by far the country's largest airline. It began canceling thousands of flights late last week, causing travel nightmares around India. The situation is improving, but passengers are still stranded all across India. The World's transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel has been tracking the situation. Jeremy, tell me more about what India's airports have looked like over the past several days.
I think the one word to describe it is chaos. In that video we just heard sound from, it's not just yelling from angry passengers. These guys were banging their hands down on the help desk counter, popping off their shirts, getting into airline employees' faces. In other videos that have been posted on social media and circulating on Indian television, you can just see scores and scores of people crammed into waiting areas with nowhere to go. Seems like little communication from the airline about what's been going on. Here's a live broadcast of the situation from the Indian TV station, NDTV.
You see here, there's an extreme fight happening right there at the counter. So many people fighting. and no answers being given to them. This is a condition. Everybody is so angry.
And Carolyn, I gotta say, this video is kind of wild to watch. You know, images are coming in live as this reporter is broadcasting, showing people literally standing on top of the customer service counters, shouting out into crowds of other angry passengers, saying that they've received no explanation at all for what's going on.
That does really sound like a nightmare, Jeremy.
Yeah.
They have not gotten an explanation. They're saying, what do we know about what's causing all of these cancellations?
We really don't know anything for sure either. It appears that there are several factors at play here. First among them is a shortage of pilots. India introduced some new rules requiring longer breaks for pilots recently. And it looks like IndiGo first began canceling flights early last week because of that shortage of pilots caused by these new break rules. But then things got worse and worse as the week went on. And on Friday, the crisis peaked. IndiGo canceled at least 1,600 flights that day.
Wow.
That's one of the worst days for air travel in India ever. And then the airline CEO, Pieter Elbers, issued a video statement saying sorry to passengers.
I, on behalf of all of us at IndiGo, would like to extend our sincerest apologies for the major inconvenience this has caused to many of our customers.
In this video, Elbers does go on to talk a little bit about what happened, and he said that the situation was the result of various causes, but that the peak of cancellations on Friday, that came from the fact that the airline decided to essentially reboot its whole system for scheduling.
Like, unplug and plug back in? It's all of its, like, computers? What does that mean?
Yeah, it seems weird, and we haven't really gotten a full explanation about why this was done or what exactly happened. Indian officials are investigating the incident as a whole. So I think we can expect some more answers about this plug out, plug in situation. But at the end of the day, I think this incident overall, regardless of the cause, is really representative of just how delicate the air travel system can be in this age now, where the number of travelers and planes across the world keep hitting record highs. And in India specifically, where this one airline, IndiGo, flies the vast majority of planes, if there's a glitch, it can just all come crashing down.
As we have very well seen these past several days, why is IndiGo such a dominant player there? Why are they running most of the flights in India?
Well, India has experienced a huge boom in aviation recently. It's right now the fastest growing market in the world. And IndiGo, which launched less than 20 years ago, has kind of ridden that new wave of demand. It represents 65% of flights in the country, more than 2,000 every day. And there's really only one competitor there, Air India, which critics say is a duopoly verging on a monopoly. I also think it's worth pointing out that the rival here, Air India, itself has not been without problems. You remember that devastating crash earlier this year that killed hundreds of people. That was operated by Air India.
That was the one that had just that one lone survivor, right?
Yeah, a single passenger, a devastating incident. And I think all of this together shows that, well, this is a huge booming aviation market in India. It's also a market in crisis. You know, on one end, Air India working to restore trust with scared passengers. And then on the other end, IndiGo trying to pull itself out of a customer service nightmare, apologizing, issuing refunds, watching its stock price tumble now. So the company hopes and plans to have things running normal at some point this week. But you know, when you've had nearly a week straight of thousands of cancellations and people still stranded, that's going to be really hard to recover from.
The world's transportation correspondent, Jeremy Siegel. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carolyn.
The National Security Strategy is a formal policy statement that every presidential administration publishes, with updates required every year, a kind of mission statement for managing global problems. The Trump administration released its National Security Strategy late last week, and reactions to it have been building ever since. We have a perspective from Latin America just ahead. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Trump administration's newly published 2025 National Security Strategy has sparked strong reactions from abroad. The Kremlin welcomed the document, saying it aligns with Russian priorities. U.S. allies in Europe expressed some shock. And in Latin America, governments there are pondering the administration's decision to introduce a so-called Trump corollary to the old Monroe Doctrine that says the U.S., quote, must be preeminent in the Western Hemisphere. Arturo Sarukhan served as Mexico's ambassador in Washington. We spoke earlier today, and he told me the Trump administration's new focus on this hemisphere offers risks and potential rewards.
Oscar Wilde said once that when the gods wish to punish us, they listen to our prayers. An American version of that would be careful what you wish for. And I mention this because many in Latin America over the last decade and a half, as U.S. interest in the hemisphere waned and as U.S. strategic focus was placed on Asia, the Indo-Pacific, relations with China, the Middle East, many were moaning about the fact that Washington was paying very little attention to the U.S. Well, now they're getting that attention, and maybe the results at the end of the day will have them tied up in knots, because there's an issue that I think will be raising red flags up and down the continent, which is what seems to be a suggestion that the U.S. will get itself involved in the domestic electoral politics of Latin American countries to ensure that there's an ideological convergence with Washington. And then on top of that, you've got a very clear decision by the U.S. to relaunch, revamp the fight against transnational criminal organizations as a new war on drugs, a militarized version of that, which we're seeing playing out in the Caribbean and the Pacific. And the mention in the strategy that the administration will selectively resort to the unilateral use of force to prevent narcotics from coming into the U.S. mainland. So that, for countries like Mexico, Colombia, Venezuela, is a red flag.
So I want to drill down into what this document actually says. So it mentions both the Monroe Doctrine and the Trump corollary. Taken together, what specific changes do those represent?
I think at a moment where critical minerals in the relationship with China has become such a salient issue, when China demonstrated to the Trump administration that it can also weaponize trade by curtailing exports of critical minerals, the issue of critical minerals in the hemisphere, I think, is in many ways one of the cornerstones of this Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which is ensure that the U.S. can depend on those supply chains of critical minerals in the Americas for strategic sectors of the U.S. economy.
So strengthen the trade relationship with South America, specifically in an effort to cut China out of some of that.
Yeah, but there's a bit of a contradiction there, because on the one hand, you want to reinforce, strengthen those supply chains of critical minerals at the same time that you've weaponized tariffs against a number of those Latin American countries that have important deposits of essential minerals. And so something's going to have to give, because you can't have your cake and eat it too. At some point, that type of contradiction will come to the surface in many ways, in the same fashion that the contradiction in the war against drugs has already surfaced by the apparent contradictions that exist between what the U.S. says it wants to do to curtail drugs from coming into the U.S. homeland and the fact that it has just pardoned a former Central American president who was arrested and indicted for his role in the trafficking of cocaine from Central America into the U.S. and into the illicit economy.
This document, this new security document, says that the U.S. will reward those aligned with U.S. principles. And then it goes on to say, quote, but we must not overlook governments with different outlooks with whom we nonetheless share interests and who want to work with us. Also seems like there's something of a contradiction there. What does that mean to you?
The way we've seen the administration supporting governments that it feels ideologically close to, whether it's bailing out the Argentinian economy, whether it's supporting governments in El Salvador, in Ecuador, trying to put its finger on the scale of the Honduran elections. But at the same time, I think it's realism kicking in. It's the fact that you've got three big countries that are not necessarily ideologically aligned to Trump and the MAGA movement, Mexico, Colombia, and Brazil, which are three of the big countries in the region. Colombia has been traditionally the most important, probably closest ally of the United States in the hemisphere for over two decades. And Brazil and Mexico, the two largest economies in the hemisphere. Mexico, one of the United States' most important trading partners. In fact, it's number one trading partner today. And as of a month ago, its largest export market in the world. And so I think this reference that you've just pointed to is sort of a wink and a nod to a certain dose of realpolitik, in the sense that there might be regimes that are not closely aligned to the MAGA vision of the world, but that the US understands, because of their economic heft, their geopolitical salience, the US will try to maintain an even keel on those three, I think, relationships, which in my mind are probably Mexico, Brazil, and Colombia.
Interesting. So overall, how big of a change do you see that the Trump administration is making in its approach to Latin America when you compare it to past U.S. administrations?
Well, we'll have to wait and see whether they, besides talking the talk, they walk the walk. But in black and white, it does seem a fundamental shift in U.S. geostrategic priorities. And in particular, if you compare it to previous Democratic and Republican administrations, which in the aftermath of the end of the Cold War, in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks against the U.S. in 2001, focused saliently on transatlantic relations, deepening the relationship with Europe, and on containing and confronting China as the most salient geostrategic rival of the United States. There does seem to be a very significant shift, and that sort of linchpin is the Americas. And I think there is some potentially good outcomes that may result from this, but there are many others that could be very troubling for many Latin American nations.
So you're a former ambassador. What would you advise Latin American heads of state right now if you were doing so?
If you look up and down the Americas today, most countries have sort of basically decided to jettison their ability to engage in regional and global affairs. Most governments and most presidents are inward looking and they are focused on domestic political issues. There's very little appetite for intra-American regional affairs. And so I think that part of this, if Latin America is going to be successful in piggybacking and doing a bit of jujitsu on the 2025 national security strategy, they're going to have to really up the ante and get up on the ring, because Latin America has been punching below its weight in the international and regional arena for quite some time now.
Arturo Sarhukan served as the Mexican ambassador to the United States from 2007 to 2013. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Donald Trump has taken numerous steps to block different pathways to citizenship for immigrants coming to or already here in the U.S. Late last month, Trump paused all pending asylum cases. As early as January, though, he had signed an executive order to halt the asylum process for migrants who enter the country through the border with Mexico. Still, U.S. government data show more than 2.3 million asylum applications pending this year. That's close to an historic high. In part one of our new series, Chasing Asylum, Elisa Resnick from KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Tucson reports that even being granted legal protections does not always mean the end of the story.
Kamel Maklad has been in the U.S. for more than 2 years now, but he hasn't actually seen much. That's because ever since crossing the border near Lukeville, Arizona, in September of 2023, he's been in immigration detention.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring. Press 1 to accept the call.
I reached him over a tinny phone line at the Eloy Detention Center south of Phoenix. We started off in Arabic.
Kif halak?
Marhaba, Elisa. Kifak?
Tamam, shukran. Wenta?
Maklad fled his home country of Syria more than a decade ago when civil war was first breaking out there. He's Druze. It's a religious minority which he says collectively decided to stay out of Syria's war. So when young men were being forced to join the military, Maklad left for Venezuela, one of the few countries where he says getting a visa as a Syrian was an option. That's how he learned to speak Spanish.
Lo compré y lo coloqué y salí allá igual que miles.
I bought my visa and I left, he says, just like others from my family and religion who decided to leave the country rather than hand it over. But he says by 2023, his work and residency permits had expired. That August, he set out for the U.S.
Gracias a Dios, pasamos bien. Llegamos a Panamá.
They passed through seven countries and the rugged Darien Gap jungle to get here.
Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, Mexico.
He turned himself in to Border Patrol agents in Arizona. A Biden-era border restriction in place at the time excluded him from getting U.S. asylum. Last year, a federal judge determined Maklad was more likely than not to be tortured if sent back to Syria and granted him what's called withholding of removal and protection under the Convention Against Torture. Kathleen Bush-Joseph with the Migration Policy Institute says this lesser form of protection is being considered more often.
Not only because of the Trump administration's restrictions on asylum, but also because of the Biden administration's restrictions.
Like the rule that prohibited Maklad from accessing full asylum back in 2023. Rights groups sued to stop the policy. The Trump administration is now defending it in court.
You're layering restriction on top of restriction.
Bush Joseph says the government can still send someone to a different country. Luis Campos, an immigration attorney in Tucson who recently took on Maklad's case, says that used to be rare. People were generally released from detention and given a work permit in the U.S. That's changed.
None of these changes work in favor of respondents like Kamel.
Almost a dozen countries will accept deportees from other places today. Venezuela isn't on that list. Nevertheless, Maklad was boarded onto a deportation flight headed there in September. He says he'd agreed after ICE assured him that he'd be accepted. But once he arrived, Venezuelan officials told him they had no knowledge of his deportation and sent him back. I remember falling into a deep sadness, he says. He was soon detained in Eloy again, back where he started in 2023. I'd been fighting for my freedom for almost 2 years, he says, doing everything the legal way. DHS did not respond to questions about the Venezuelan flight. But in an email, Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin called Maklad a suspected terrorist and a serious threat to the public and said he would not be released into the U.S. But DHS didn't provide evidence, and Maklad's name doesn't appear in any U.S. District Court filing.
The optics of this case are terrible. A gentleman won his case in an immigration court. The government refuses to release him.
Attorney Luis Campos again.
They've tried an illegal rendition to a third country. That didn't work. It looks terrible. So how do they fix this? Let's call him a terrorist.
Attorneys are trying to file a special petition to force the case before a judge. But for now, Maklad is stuck in detention.
Estoy gastando a mí mismo, a mi cuerpo. Me siento acabando aquí.
I'm wearing myself out, he says. I'm wasting away. For The World, I'm Elisa Resnick, Tucson, Arizona.
This reporting on changes to the asylum system continues with a look at people who are now thinking that Mexico, not the U.S., is the place to settle. Listen for the next story in the series, Chasing Asylum, tomorrow on The World.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
In Benin, in West Africa, a group of mutineers calling themselves the Committee for Refoundation staged an attempted coup over the weekend. The group seized control of the national television station yesterday, announced the government was out, and dismissed President Patrice Talon. But by the afternoon, the Beninese military had thwarted the coup attempt, arresting several people behind the plot as others fled.
In eastern Congo, a bomb exploded and killed more than 30 people in the town of Sangi during a skirmish between the Congolese army and a pro-government militia. This less than a week after Congolese leaders signed a peace deal brokered by the U.S. that's aimed at ending the conflict between Congolese forces and the M23 rebel group.
Staying on the subject of U.S. brokered peace deals, a ceasefire between Thailand and Cambodia was disrupted when fighting between their militaries broke out overnight. Today, Thailand also launched an airstrike on Cambodia. Both sides blame the other for breaking the ceasefire. The fighting overnight was the most intense violence in that border conflict since the 5 days of combat in July that prompted the U.S. to intervene. And that is a few things you might have missed.
An ancient pleasure boat matching descriptions from the era of Cleopatra has been discovered off the coast of Alexandria, Egypt. Researchers say the vessel dates back to the first century and was used by the royal court for excursions and carried crowds of revelers. Franck Godiot led the research team that discovered the boat. He is the president of the European Institute for Underwater Archaeology.
It was used for pleasure. It was a pleasure barge, 35 meters long.
So about 100 feet.
100 feet long, without mast. It was a rowing boat, quite an impressive rowing boat.
And what was it used for? You said a pleasure boat. What exactly did that mean?
People from the court used to have those pleasure boats in order to sail alongside the river and the channel of Alexandria.
So how do you know what you know about this boat? What's the source of the ancient information on this?
We had some description of ancient authors like Strabo about this type of boat called Talamagos. And we had also a representation dating back from the 2nd century BC in a mosaic called the Palestrina Mosaic. Thus, the existence of such a boat was perfectly known, but it had never been discovered before.
Mm. Now, Strabo was a Greek geographer, and I have a quote in front of me from him about these boats. That it says, "Every day and every night is crowded with people on the boats who play the flute and dance without restraint and with extreme licentiousness."
Yes, Strabo was a little bit shocked by the feast held in the Canopic Channel between Alexandria and the city of Canopus.
And so that was a Greek geographer. This is a time period when the Greeks were in charge of this part of Egypt at this point?
The Greeks were reigning on Egypt since Alexander the Great, since 300 years. Alexandria was under the rule of the Greek kings, the Ptolemies, and people were speaking Greek in Alexandria. And Strabo came to Alexandria about 29-25 BC and spent 3 years in Alexandria studying in the library, the great library of Alexandria.
So this discovery comes from an interesting point in history in this area. What would the city of Alexandria have been like at the time that this boat was sailing?
Well, it was the time of the glory of the city of Alexandria. It was at the end of the Ptolemaic dynasty. The island of Enterodos had a palace on it and a temple to the goddess Isis. There were multiple temples and palaces in the great harbor of Alexandria, and it was recorded as the most magnificent city in the world.
So let's talk about your discovery, fast forward to present day. How much of the actual wood is down there still? How much of the boat can you actually still see?
We can see the whole bottom of the hull on 28 meters long and 7 meters wide. And on the very well-preserved wood, we even found some Greek inscriptions.
Greek inscriptions. Do you know what they say?
Well, we are trying to translate them, but it's a little bit difficult because they are not readable everywhere. Thus, we are doing a study. But what we can say already is that those inscriptions from their style dates back for early 1st century AD.
Wow. 2,000 years old, just about.
Absolutely, 2,000 years old. And the boat has been found just nearby a temple to the goddess Isis, that we found on the island, and we made excavation for years on that temple. Thus, it could have been also that this boat was attached to the temple and sank at the same time the temple sank into the port during an earthquake around 50 AD.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So it was potentially attached to the temple to the Egyptian goddess Isis?
Yes. In this case, the boat would have belonged to the temple.
So what happens next with this shipwreck now that you have identified it?
Well, we have studied it. We made a very precise stereophotogrammetry of it. We have it in 3D now. We took the wood sample. We will do some carbon dating, but the dating is secured. We will do a wood analysis to know the type of wood it has been built with. And we will make a nice scientific publication on it.
But you will not try to remove it from the water and put it on display, right? That would kind of destroy the very old wood.
Yes. UNESCO is recommending to let the remain of the ship where they have been found and to cover them very well after being studied and excavated. Mm. But of course, in some case, the wood could be brought to museum, but it needs a lot of conservation, which take years and years. And it depends upon the Egyptian authority, because that excavation has been done with the Ministry of Tourism and Antiquity of Egypt.
Franck Godio led the research team that discovered an ancient boat just off the coast of Alexandria, Egypt. He's the president of the European Institute for Underwater Archaeology and spoke with us from Paris.
Electronic LED screens are pretty much everywhere. That might be one reason why an old-fashioned type of signage is enjoying a little renaissance right now in France. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Paris.
Men, women, and shoes. Those are the words that artisanal letter painter Victor Baer needs to get onto a wall today in gold leaf. His client, this hip Parisian clothing store called Asphalt. The gig's just a few words, but it'll take Baer all day, which is fine by him.
C'est une passion.
This is my passion, he says, as he rummages through an old wooden tackle box filled with brushes, paints, and emulsions. I could spend my life doing this, he says. Baer's got today's words printed to size on rectangular sheets of paper. Transforming them into gold leaf is an art that dates back to the early 19th century. Baer climbs his folding ladder, tapes the paper against the wall above some shelves of fashionable shoes. Instead of cutting the letters out entirely, he says, like you do in traditional stenciling and painting in the spaces, I make hundreds of pinholes following the contours of each of my letters. Baer then taps and rubs the paper against the wall with a special talcum powder dispenser. The white powder passes through his tiny pinholes. When he takes the paper away, there's the outline of his words in little white talc dots. So far, so good. Lettering, whether gold leaf or engravings or acrylic paint on windows, requires patience, Baer tells me. He's been at this for 11 years now and is busier than ever. So are the other dozen or so artisans like him in Paris. And to think that they were nearly wiped out by this. Decals, plastic printouts that you stick straight onto your windows or walls. They came on the scene in the 1980s, Baer says. It was cheaper and faster to print stickers. A lot of letter painters hung up their brushes, he says, because they were scared of the new machines. If we don't embrace them, they thought, we're dead. But guess what, Baer says? The stickers did what stickers do over time. They came unstuck.
C'est pas forcément le max de la durabilité.
Decals are not known for durability, he says. The vinyl ones crack, and if they're exposed to the sun, they age badly. Right about the time people were souring on decals, Baer says, COVID struck. When Parisians emerged from lockdown 7 long weeks later, artisans like Baer became stars of sorts.
Alors disons qu'il y a eu un gros réveil après Covid parce que il y a eu un rebond d'activité.
Everyone was just dying to get back outside and do stuff, he says. Business activity picked up. Restaurants and hotels wanted to renovate. and they wanted to go back to traditional things after all that uncertainty, which is why the store's manager, Jonathan Gauthier, called Ber.
Donc c'est un savoir-faire qui fait partie de l'histoire des magasins de Paris, et donc c'était important pour nous d'avoir aussi ce rendu.
What Baird does, he says, it's part of the history of stores in Paris. It was important for us to embrace this. Plus, we wanted to give the shop a little cachet, he says. Gold leaf lettering enriches our image. Up on his ladder, Baird's now filling in his talcum powder letters, sans serif, with a mix of paint and glue. He uses a brush exactly the width of the characters. Like calligraphy, this is one-stroke work.
En fait, c'est justement quand on est en manque d'assurance qu'on fait les erreurs.
If you lack confidence, you make mistakes, Baird says, so you just take a deep breath and tell yourself it's all going to work out. If Baird slips up, paints outside the lines, he'll have to start from scratch. But he's done other jobs where you simply cannot err. He did the engraving on the tombstone of a late French prime minister, Michel Rocard. It reads, "Happiness to the artisans of peace." On another job, he made tiny inscriptions on $5,000 bottles of wine.
Une fois, je me suis trompé sur l'orthographe pour un parfum.
I've only messed up once, Baird says, as he slowly presses sheets of gold leaf against his gluey letters. I ruined a $200 bottle of men's perfume, which meant he had to buy it.
Malheureusement, le parfum me plaisait pas.
Sadly for me, he says, I didn't like the scent. For The World, I'm Sherry Haddon, Paris.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. As Turkey looks ahead to its next presidential election in 2028, critics of the current leadership say political repression is getting worse. The brutal murder of journalist Hakan Tosun has reignited concerns about the country's justice system, along with the threats faced by those who dare to criticize the government's record on the environment. Reporter Elena Gostoli has been looking into the case.
On a gray afternoon in Istanbul, the funeral of murdered journalist Hakan Tosun feels less like a goodbye and more like a protest. Hundreds turned up. Many of them only knew Hakan as the journalist who would spend days, even weeks or years, documenting to protect the environment, sometimes, friends say, with barely 100 lira in his pocket. Now it was their turn to show up for him after he was beaten to death on a street in Istanbul back in October. Forests and rivers are crying for Hakan, says one of the chants as mourners call for justice. The words, "What happened to Hakan Tosun," are printed on a black and white banner at the front of the funeral procession headed towards the Cemevi in northwest Istanbul. A house of worship for Alevis, a religious minority Hakan belonged to. One of the people carrying that banner is Alper Can Kilic, one of his friends.
We don't know what actually happened, but he was a very important person. He's going everywhere in Turkey where there's a demonstration or there's a, something wrong about the rights. He always doing the right thing. Show everything to humanity and the government and the people. Because of that, he always he can have lots of enemies.
Weeks after his death, Hakan's family, friends and supporters are still looking for answers. On the night of October 10th, Hakan Tosun was beaten on a street in Esenyurt, one of Istanbul's most chaotic districts, a place of rapid development, high rises, and increasing gang crime. He was found unconscious. Two men, just 18 and 24, were arrested. Security footage shows them attacking him twice, striking his head again and again as he lay on the ground. 2 days later, he died in hospital of a brain hemorrhage. The unanswered questions are many. Critical camera footage was never collected. Some recordings were retrieved not by police, but reportedly by relatives of the suspects. And the video that could have shown the clearest view from a shop right next to where the attack happened never reached investigators. Lawyer Onur Çingil says these gaps, along with the fact that a third person seen riding a motorcycle at the scene was never taken into custody, cast a long shadow over the investigation.
There should have been three arrests, not two. We formally requested it.
but the prosecutor's office refuses to issue the order. Of course, this undermines the integrity of the investigation. Witnesses may be threatened or blackmailed. Some camera footage was never recovered.
Hakan's family didn't find out he'd been hospitalized until 27 hours after the attack, long after his relatives had filed a missing person report. He'd been brought in with no identification. During those crucial hours, an online campaign had already started under the hashtag Where is Hakan Tosun? His sister Osnur believes that without that public pressure, the outcome could have been very different.
The first question we asked was, where is Hakan Tosun? We learned where he was with the support of his friends. If Hakan Tosun hadn't been loved so much, he would have disappeared in the hospital, and we wouldn't have been able to find him. Maybe we wouldn't have been able to find the perpetrators either.
Turkish police say they have assigned two inspectors to investigate. The Interior Ministry has not responded to a request for comment on the concerns surrounding the investigation. Activists and press freedom groups are now asking, was this random violence or was Hakan Tosun targeted for who he was? And are the young men who were arrested really the ones behind the killing? Since the Gezi Park protests, which started as a small effort to save a city park in Istanbul, environmental activists in Turkey have been under growing pressure. Protests are criminalized and local communities fighting projects backed by powerful political or business interests have fewer and fewer ways to challenge them, whether in court or on the streets. Just this November, the government introduced a new rule that gives the presidency the final say on mining permits, another blow to independent oversight of major extraction projects. Many attacks against environmental defenders like Hakan Tosun follow a troubling pattern. A violent death, questions raised, but justice never fully achieved. Since Hakan's death, his sister Osnur has been speaking out everywhere she can. Environmental groups hold vigils and screenings of his documentaries to keep his name from fading and to keep pressure on the authorities, because without that pressure, many, including lawyer Onur Çingil, believe nothing will happen.
We will continue to ask these questions. As much as this is a documentation issue, as much as this is an activist issue, this is also about the right to live safely in Istanbul and in Turkey. There are other files like this. I say the same thing about all of them. As long as the Ministry of Justice does not press on these issues, we have come to a point where justice is sought in the press statements, in the statements in front of the courthouse, not in the courts.
İlenia Gostuli, Istanbul.
Iraq has been dealing with a severe drought for the past 7 years. 2025 has been one of Iraq's driest years in nearly a century. If you guess that climate change is to blame, you'd be partially right. We'll fill in the rest of that story for you tomorrow.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego.
You can find us online anytime at theworld.org, as well as more of our original reporting on YouTube, and subscribe to the channel while you're there. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening. We will catch you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.
PRX.